It's time for another episode of the Cultural Hall, and it's episode 111. We've arrived. Sorry we haven't had a numbered episode for a while.
Well, 111 is a very special number to
right?
me.
Right? 111. Why?
Because that was my troop number in
was
Boy
it
Scouts.
Really?
Yes, we are Troop 111 in Salt Lake City.
Let's hear your cheer.
We're 111. We didn't have one.
Cheer.
Cheer. 111. We're number one. 111. We're number one.
Coming up in the second and third block, we'll be talking to Jenny Shelton Proctor, who is an author of a book, many books, as a matter of fact.
I wonder if her husband's a doctor.
Yeah?
Yeah.
A proctorologist?
Well, I was just thinking Dr. Proctor.
Stupid. Dr. Proctor. I can't remember. She actually tells me what he does. They have like a zillion kids.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this interview was recorded a couple months ago, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So I'll pull back the curtain a little bit. So we get to where we do a bunch of interviews.
Yes.
And then I kind of go, all right, I'm going to take a break for a little while. And then we just kind of air those interviews as we get a chance to get to them.
Yes.
So I did this interview, and then it was maybe 3 or 4 weeks afterwards, and we hadn't published it yet. And Jenny reaches out to me and says, was there something wrong? Was the interview not any good? Did you not want to share it? Because I totally understand if it wasn't any good and you don't want to share it, but...
Yeah, you have too many kids.
Yeah. Too many kids. So I was like, no, we're going to get to it. It's just, you know, we've had other things that have gone on. There was the bishop that dressed up like the homeless man. There was this guy who... You know, everything with the same-sex marriage. So we've had some things come up.
And where is she from?
She is in, you would ask me that, like Virginia.
Okay.
She's back east.
Okay.
No, North Carolina. One of the Carolinas. South Carolina.
Okay, well, Sister Proctor, we're finally here. And you can show it off to all your friends, your family, your peers.
I feel embarrassed that I don't know. Will you look up real quick where she's from? It's Carolina, one of the Carolinas, I'm pretty sure.
What's her name again?
Jenny Shelton Proctor. Episode 111 of the Cultural Hall, Rob. Let me share this email with you. This is from Mary Johnston. And it's good that our friend Jenny is a author because it has to do with this email. Mr. Stedman and the Cultural Hall podcast team, hello and my apologies for this random reach out. I'm writing in regard to an anthology that my team is assembling for History Press, roughly titled Wasatch Front Reflections, to be published in late 2014. We intend to be an amazing literary tribute to this area of the state and a rich collection of creative, place-based essays, that's creative nonfiction narrative, memoir, research-based history, or immersion journalism, and poetry. Despite the fact that we have already gathered an amazing collection of pieces from some seriously renowned authors, seriously, we're giddy about gathering pieces from these folks, we are missing written pieces from one major perspective of this state, the Mormon community and Mormon writers in Utah. We've reached out to many that we know of and have been unfruitful in our efforts. The New York Times once accused the Mormon culture of lacking a literary renaissance, and we are hungry to prove them wrong by demonstrating some great creative nonfiction written by Mormons from an LDS perspective in this collection. I am adamant that this anthology will not be published without this perspective included in at least 2 to 3 pieces, and I'm reaching out to you and your team to see if you or anyone you know might like to contribute a place-based nonfiction piece for this publication. I know you are all quite busy, but if you could take a look at the following submission description that illustrates the energy direction we are hoping to build with Wasatch Front Reflections, I would greatly appreciate it. Please let me know if you are either A, willing to contribute a new piece for the project, or B, have an unpublished or published piece that might fit the project. If you are curious to see a few examples of the type of writing work that have already been submitted, I'd be happy to email a few to you as well as supply a list of authors that have already submitted to demonstrate the credibility of this project. Unfortunately, our timeline for gathering submissions is quite narrow, and we are needing to gather pieces within the next 2 to 3 weeks. I know this timeline is tight, but given my research into your work, I'm very hopeful that one of you, or some talented writers that you know, have a perfect piece waiting to find a home in this ambitious anthology, or that you know of an already published piece that might work. Please feel free to contact me via email or by phone number should you have any questions. My sincere thanks for your time in reading this email. Sincerely, Mary Van Leeuwen Johnston, co-editor of Wasatch Front Reflections.
Okay, so once more, she wants what kind of a story? A
nonfiction. Well, here it is. Wasatch Front Reflections is seeking place-based essay, creative nonfiction narrative memoir, research-based history, or immersion journalism pieces from 1,500 words to 2,500 words in length. The collective works will provide a broad overview of the area, honor all aspects of culture, challenge the stereotypes, and explore the confluence of community, culture, and identity in the Wasatch Front. So if that's you, you can hit me up. Her email is maryjohnston@gmail.com, and that's maryjohnston@gmail.com.
So when she says our team, she's actually reaching out to... Richie is now reaching out to our listeners.
Yeah, that's our team.
Yeah, and if you get something published, let us know.
Yeah, we'll talk to these folks from here. It's Mary Johnston again with a UN at gmail.com. All right, so here's episode 111.
Wait. Jenny Proctor was born in the mountains of West North Carolina.
West North Carolina. See, that's why I got confused.
A place she still resides and considers the loveliest on earth. She hikes to spend time with her husband and six children. Runs because her love for food requires it, and writes because it keeps her calm in otherwise crazy world. Jenny's first novel, The House of Rose Creek, was released in 2013.
So you can hear all about her first novel. We talk about that. And you can hear As I Make It Awkward and Encourage Her to Go for the Seventh Child. That's coming up in the second and third block of the Cultural Hall.
Running a small business today can be difficult enough. Imagine all the work you have to do to market it. Imagine the hours you put in to create promotional materials for it. Now, imagine a partner that can help you with all of that and more. Imagine Lennon Design. Lennon Design is your partner in business when you need a professional look at a price you can afford. Whether it's websites, advertising media, promotional materials, and more, Lennon Design can help you promote your business. When you need creative, affordable designs, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Time for a special episode of the Cultural Hall, all the way in one of the Carolinas. It's North Carolina? South Carolina.
North Carolina.
Whoa, I know. We shouldn't have said South Carolina, right? That's a big feud.
Not always. It depends on who you talk to.
It's Jenny Shelton Proctor, author of the book The House at Rose Creek. Now, I'm going to read the email. We've shared this on the Cultural Hall before, but I want to share how this email or how this episode came about. It says, "Hello, Cultural Hall," writes Jenny. So I just typed up, let me skip that part, actually. Here we go. "So I'm terrible at self-promotion." By the way, great and best line, first line of an email ever. "But I wrote a book back in July. It's published through Covenant Communications, and it's selling pretty well." We'll get into that. I want to know what well means. "That's not a reason that I think I would be an awesome guest on the Cultural Hall podcast, though it does make me happy. But there are reasons that I think I would be a great guest and be really fun. First of all, I live in North Carolina, a state that is different from Utah. My book is about North Carolina, so it's different than a lot of books that are written about people living in Utah. I might need to back up because it sounds like I'm trash-talking Utah, which you were, but that's okay."
I was not.
"It's okay." She says, "I love Utah, but North Carolina is different." "Yes, and the culture here is very different. We hate South Carolina, too," she says. No, I'm kidding. That might have been editorialized. "It might be fun to talk about it, yeah? Secondly, the book is called The House at Rose Creek. It's about family history and family relationships and has some romance in it, too." Ooh, ooh, ooh. "But not too much." I loved that line. That was one of my favorite lines of this. "It has romance, but hey, not too much. I tried really hard not to make myself gag while writing it. It's also a conversion story, which I know makes many people want to gag as well. But hey, I don't think it's too preachy. It's a different kind of conversion story because it's North Carolina. So I think that has it going for it. Get in touch with me. Let's do an episode. Blah, 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 blah." Here you are on the phone. How are things in North Carolina today?
You know, they're good. It's a little rainy and it's starting to get cold, but there's lots of beautiful fall colors. So
is North Carolina
a great place to be right now?
Is North Carolina a snow place? Do you guys get snow?
You know, in our part of the state, I am far west in the mountains, and we get a little bit of snow, not as much as you get out there. We might have, you know, two or three good snows per year.
Yeah, a good hearty snow. Like, is it snowman snow? Are we talking that much?
It's really wet snow, so sometimes you can get good snowmen, you know, it's really kind of slushy because it never stays cold enough for the snow to stick around for a long time. So you get snow and then it melts a little and then maybe some of it will freeze. And, you know, like we live in a place where we get like a half inch of snow and they cancel school.
Yes, that's the best. Those are the best places.
Well, and you have like two snowplows for your whole town. So you just can't, you just don't have the manpower. And all the roads are really curvy and windy and they go through the mountains. And so, you know, there's a lot of places that it would be really hard to get out of when it does snow. So.
Is it a little
we do get some here.
Is it a little backwoods there, would you say?
Well, I guess that depends on your definition of backwoods.
Oh, so you're going to throw the question back on me, huh? You're not just going to...
Well, I mean, by what? Like, I live in a really small town. Like, I'm almost as far west as you can go into North Carolina before you get to Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, it's back in the mountains, and there's some, you know, some old Appalachian traditions that would probably make a little people say, that is backwoods. But, you know, it's a great place to live. It's beautiful here. People are really kind and wonderful, you know.
I generally don't do any research about the guests. You listen to the Cultural Hall, so you know I normally just go, and then we kind of fall on a really great interview. But
right.
I went to JennyProctor.com, and I clicked on the About Me, because I was like, I don't even know what I'm dealing with here.
Make sure I'm not some psychopath from North Carolina.
Right? Yeah, right? A little backwoods. But I started to read a little bit about you, and I kind of want to like end this interview now so you can go be with your six kids. Are you kidding me?
I know. It's a lot, huh?
Twins? Are any of them twins, or is that
no,
six kids?
No, I do have a set of twins. Oh. So my oldest is 12.
Okay.
And he's at school right now. And then I have 9-year-old twins. They're almost 10. They'll be 10 next week.
Boy or girl? Boys or girls?
One of each.
Oh, nice.
A boy and a girl. The twins are boy-girl. And then I have a 6-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter. And then the baby, another little boy. He is 18 months old.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and the three in the middle that are school-age, they're fourth grade, first grade. We homeschool those three. So they're actually all here right now. But the baby's sleeping and the little ones are, you know, watching cartoons and have been threatened sufficiently that they should stay out of my hair for for the duration.
Unless you are bleeding or dying, do not bother mommy. She is on the phone.
Right. This is important. All the way from Utah. Don't come in here. No, they're good kids. They're good kids. And they're pretty self-sufficient. My oldest daughter is one of the twins. She's 10. And she could totally, if it were legal, could run the house if I let her.
Really?
So, yeah. She's a good one.
Homeschool, that's kind of different. How come?
You know what? This is actually only our second week doing homeschool. Isn't that crazy?
Yes. Homeschool in general, I think, is crazy a little bit. Like, to me, that's... I feel like school is like when it's like, oh, cool, now I don't have to worry about it. It's someone else's problem.
Yeah. No, I get that. And we've actually been a huge advocate of public education for a long time. And my oldest is still in school, but... I don't know. It probably would deserve its own podcast if we got into this subject too extensively. But basically, North Carolina is sort of in a really bad spot as far as education goes right now. We are, as far as funding and teacher incentives and things like that, we're sort of at the bottom.
No, Utah's at the bottom, pal.
You want to fight over that?
Yes. We pride ourselves on how much we don't pay our teachers and how much we don't invest in our students.
Yay, we're so bad. Well, North Carolina is pretty bad, too. And in the state of North Carolina, the county where I live is even worse. It's a very, there's a lot of retirement people here and not a whole lot of people that are enthusiastic about spending a lot of money on the school. So, you know, things like our property tax is the lowest in the state and you know, someone proposes to increase it by 0.5% so that we can build a new elementary school and, you know, the old people come out in full force picketing, saying, no, no, no new school. So, I am probably exaggerating a little bit there. But the point is, our classrooms for my kids this year were, you know, they lost their teacher's aid and they lost their funding, and there was just a not a lot of resources to give my kids what they needed. So I always said that if we found ourselves in a situation where I felt like they would be better off at home, that I would pull them home. So that's what we did just last week. Although, don't ask me how it went this morning. I called my husband this morning and I said, we have made a colossal mistake. Because it was just one of those mornings. But I think we're going to pull through. I think it'll be fun. And I like having them around, and you know, I can give them individualized instruction a lot more than they can get at school. So,
meanwhile, the oldest one is like, "Why do I have to go to school? No one else is going to school."
He really campaigned hard to get to stay in school. I was like, "Are you sure?" But he's all, you know, he's seventh grade. He's getting ready to try out for the basketball team. You know, yeah. He's got lots of things that he wants to focus on. And ideally, I hope that we'll be in a situation where we can let the older kids, you know, when the younger kids get older, that they would be able to do high school. And because, you know, I think there's something to that American high school experience with sports and, you know, journalism and, I mean, whatever, all the things that I did that I really enjoyed. I don't know, maybe they'll feel differently and they won't want to do that, but.
Yeah, the introduction is always weird. How many people were in your last school? Four. Four in your grade? Nope. Or was mom?
Four total.
Yeah. But you're liking doing it. That's cool. I don't know that every mom would be able to be like, "Oh, all right, I'll do the homeschool thing."
Yeah, it's pretty scary. It's pretty scary, and I still really don't have any idea what I'm doing. So,
well, I want you to know that if it doesn't work out, entirely your fault. So you have that to look forward to.
Thank you. That's awesome. I'll remember you said that.
let's get into this. How did you get into writing?
Well, it's kind of a funny story. So I never, like, I mean, I wrote papers in high school and I got good grades.
Okay.
And, you know, I did write, but, and I had journals. I wrote lots of journals, but I never really thought about writing, creatively. And then I had a friend email me, this is probably 6-7 years ago when the whole mommy blog thing was just huge and everyone had a blog and, you know, that was a really big part of the online culture was everyone blogging. And
uh-huh.
So she sent me an email and she said, or maybe she said it in person, "You should start a blog. You would be so good at this." So I thought, well, I don't want to do that. I mean, really, at first, it was like, this is kind of dumb. Why would I want to do this? But then a few months later, I was reading some other blogs that I thought were funny, and I thought, okay, well, let's try. So I started blogging. My first blog was Mommy Snark.
Okay.
Was the name of my blog. And all of my kids were really little. I had twins that were like 2 years old. You know, so life was totally crazy all the time, and that's what I wrote about. I wrote about my kids and how funny they were and the funny things they said and, you know, people coming up to you in the grocery store and saying, "Oh, are your twins identical? It's a boy
and a girl. And you're like, "Yes, actually."
They are, and I actually said to one woman, I don't know if I can say this word on a podcast.
You can.
I looked at her square in the face, and I said, "No, see, this one has blue eyes, and this one has brown eyes, and this one has dark hair, and this one has light hair, and this one has a penis."
Yeah.
And she just looked at me like,
oh.
So they can't be identical. Totally different DNA. So, you know, I would share stories like that on the blog. My first blog post that I wrote, which is my other favorite funny story about having lots of kids, particularly having lots of kids in the South, because, I mean, we are like a walking freak show around here. Like, I see people counting when they see me with my entire family at the park. Like, one, two,
you pull up and it's like
God.
A clown car. It's like, how many more do they got crammed in there?
I mean, really, like, you just don't see many families with lots and lots of kids. And I had one woman, I was going to a thrift store to donate, a whole bunch of clothes that we'd outgrown to this store. And she was, I opened up the back of the car and I was pregnant, I think with my fourth baby at this point. So she's unloading all of these bags, helping me unload all of these bags out of the van. And she looked at me and she looked at my pregnant belly and then she looked at the three kids in the car and she went, "Haven't you figured out what causes that yet?" Just real Southern, real twangy. And I looked at her and without missing a beat, I was so proud of myself because, you know, sometimes after the fact, you'll think, "Oh, I
you know what I should
have
said."
It would have been
yeah.
So funny. So I looked at her and I went, "Yeah, but if you could see my husband, you'd know why I can't stop."
Oh yeah, woo!
And like after I said it, I thought, "Oh, I can't believe I just said that. I can't believe I just admitted that to a stranger. I'm so embarrassed." But in retrospect, it was pretty funny. And it's such a personal question when people that don't know you just sort of insert themselves into your business and say, you know, "Why are you still having children?" Essentially, that's what they're saying.
Yeah.
So, you know. So, I'm totally getting off on these crazy
things. Oh, no, you're fine. I love every bit of it.
So, I was blogging these stories and talking about it, and I sometimes I would blog about serious things, too. I mean, I really take my responsibility as a mom very seriously, and I think it's the most important thing that I do. And so I talked about that, about those feelings that I had too. I ran something called the Joyful Mothering Series, which we can actually talk about in a little bit because I'm going to turn it into a book. But
oh, nice.
Yeah, so I talked about being a mom. And I had, you know, eventually I started to build. It was never a huge following. But, you know, I started to get some consistent readers, and I had people start to say, you know, you're a good writer. Have you ever thought about writing? And so I took a creative writing class through independent study from BYU just to see how I felt about it. And I totally fell in love. I wrote a short story, and that was the beginning of it all. I sort of said, wow, this is really, really fun. So then I wrote a book.
So, yeah, and I'm sure it just went like that, right?
You got done with the class.
And it's like, boom, and then there was a book, and now we're talking. That's how that went. That was yesterday that I took the BYU Independent Study course, and then last night I wrote that book, and then today we're talking.
Right, I just blinked, and it was all done. No work at all involved in there.
When you talk about your blog and having some success, like, what are we talking? Because we've had some pretty big bloggers here on the Cultural Hall. Or are you talking, like, into the tens of thousands, the thousands?
Oh, gosh, no. It was never that big. I mean, I might have had 500 or 600 consistent readers. I mean, I would get up, you know, close to 1,000 page views occasionally. But it never really took off. And I don't know. There was probably a part of me that really wished that it had gotten bigger. But, it, you know, for whatever reason, it just never really exploded much beyond that small following. But I kind of liked that because what I hated about the blogging was that reciprocal, like, you know, I'll read your blog if you read my blog. And, I don't have time to sit and like, build a social following by reading all of these other blogs. I mean, I've got 6 kids, and I had 4 kids and then 5 kids. I mean, I didn't have the time to invest that sort of, you know, you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. And so sure. there were blogs that I liked and that I read and that I tried to follow, but it was never, you know, you just have to draw the line somewhere. And so, you know, I wrote when I wanted to write, and I appreciated the comments and the support that I got.
And then that leads you to writing a book. So where did you get the idea for the book? It's a fiction book, as I understand
it. It is fiction. And so the short story that I wrote, the premise of the book is it's about a woman who learns about her own family history, and in the things that she learns, there's some parallels that sort of help her progress through this journey that she's going on in her own life. And so the short story that I wrote for that creative writing class through BYU was actually the story of the ancestor.
Okay.
That is then later in the book. And so I wrote his story first, and it was actually based on a family history story in my own family. And so, you know, Wiley is the name. His name is Ian Wiley in the book, and that's one of my family names, is Wiley. And so, there's a few parallels there. What the story in my own family that inspired it was I had, I think, 4 generations up. So, you know, 3 greats or 4 greats along in there somewhere.
But pretty awesome, whether it's 3 greats or 4 greats.
Right. Yeah. Like, just old.
Yeah.
Old. A long time ago. We had an ancestor who... We found his ship passage, record of him coming across from Scotland to the United States. And so then, and he was by himself. He had a wife and he had 4 kids, but they stayed in Scotland. And so I have an uncle who really loves family history, and he and I puzzled over this for a little while. Why would he have come by himself? And then it took us a while, but finally we found record of his wife and the 4 children, and it was something like 6 years later that they came across to the United States, and they were all reunited, and then it was something like 9 or 10 months after that, after the wife and the kids got to America, that my great-great-grandfather was born. And, you know, they named him after George Washington, presumably because he was the first baby born in the United States.
Oh, cool.
And so, I just thought about that situation, what those feelings must have been, you know, how desperate were they to make a better life for him to come first. I can only speculate, but maybe it was financial. He came across, and when he had enough money to pay for his wife and his children to join him, he sent him the money, and they came. And, you know, we'll never know what the exact circumstances
sure.
were within their family. But I just, it created a really human story for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of inspired the events that happened in the book.
But with writing a book being such a huge undertaking, even with such a great idea as far as that goes, I mean, six kids for crying out loud. So how do you figure out and do that?
Yeah.
You know, because well, I've got a bunch of great ideas for books, but because my life is such, it's like, well, those are great ideas.
Right. Right. And then they just stay there.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the first book was written almost entirely between the hours of 11 p.m. and 3 a.m.
Which is insanity to me.
Yes. It is. My husband swears that I have taken years off my life because I have, you know, existed on so little sleep for so many years now. Huh. And really, like, I'm not old. Like, I'm 32, so it's not like I'm really old.
Oh,
like,
for all these years!
When I hit my 30s, my husband was like, seriously, you can't do this anymore. And he's kind of right. Like, I've started writing early in the morning because I will sit at my keyboard at 11:45 and be like, I'm so tired.
Yeah. Eyes shutting, can't keep body upright. And he wakes up and there's like 10,000 pages of the letter L across because you fell asleep on your keyboard.
That has actually happened more than once.
No.
Where I just get these long, like, I mean, I've fallen asleep with my fingers, like, on the keyboard. So I've been going to sleep like a normal person and then just waking up, you know, super early and starting, you know, I'll write from, like, 5:15 to 7 before the kids wake up. So, but, yeah, it was mostly done in the middle of the night, the first one was. And, you know, I would write for 3 or 4 nights in a row, and then when I felt myself start to shut down, I would get a couple of good nights of sleep, and then I would go back to it. But I sort of committed to myself when I started this that I would write very little during the day, at least while my children are small.
Is that just to avail time to be with your kids?
Yeah. I mean, and really it's mental too, because when I'm writing, I get really focused and you sort of zoom in on where the story's going and you can't stop the distractions from coming. Kids that need you, they want to ask for something, they want to tell you something. And the few times that I tried writing, I would find that I would get really snappy. Mm-hmm. They would come to me and ask me a question, and it would be like, hold on, I'm writing. And, you know, I don't want it to be something that they resent, that, you know, they grow up and they remember that all Mom did was sit at her computer all the time. So I try. There are times where I've had deadlines, edits that needed to be done, where I've had to, you know, find ways where they can work around me and they can sit and color while I edit or, you know, things like that. Sometimes you just have to make it work, but...
Has your 12-year-old read it?
He's read most of it. He read, like, I put the PDF of the before it came out. I put it on the Kindle, just the final proof version that my publisher sent me, and I think he got through most of it. My daughter has read it. The 10-year-old, she's read it. My 10-year-old son tried, and he was like, I don't like romance.
What did the 10-year-old think?
Oh, she liked it. She really liked it. Oh,
is it?
It's fun to have them read and want to talk to me about it.
And then how is husband with it? Pretty good.
Yeah, he's very supportive. He is, you know, probably my biggest fan. He always reads them before they come out. And there's a second one that's coming out next year in August,
which is called
From Covenant. It doesn't have a name yet. Its working title is Mountains Between Us, but. Authors don't normally get to title their books.
What? So. No, that's not true, is it?
It's totally true. Like, I mean, I'm sure that there's, if you're J.K. Rowling, you probably get to name your own books.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I listened to your interview with Richard Paul Evans. He probably gets to name his books.
Mm-hmm.
but, you know, generally speaking, you have a marketing team, and they decide you get to have input. Like, you tell them what you like, but ultimately... they will decide, and really, they know what sells and what doesn't,
sure.
And what's going to make people pick things up, and you know who your demographic is and who you're marketing to. So,
does your is your husband able to give you advice as far as like he's reading? He's like, well, what about this, or is it just a thing where you're like, nope, this is my deal. Thank you for being supportive.
No, he's really great about letting me, particularly through the writing process. He is such a good listening ear to, you know, hear me work through plot. Ideas and things that I want to do. I normally have to preface it and say, okay, we're going to talk about some pretend people for a little while. And there are times where he said, you know what, I can't do it right now. we've got, let's talk about the kids. I've got some things I want to talk to you about. Then we'll talk about the made up people.
Let's come back to real life for a second, Jenny.
Right.
We need to talk about real life because kids are hungry and we need to,
Well, and there was one particularly entertaining moment where I think this was probably in the waiting. Like, I was waiting to hear back from the publisher, so I didn't yet know that the book was going to be published. And he came home and he told me something very exciting that had happened to one of his coworkers at work. And I looked at him and I said, oh my gosh, that's just like Kate, who is the main character in The House at Rose Creek. And he looked at me and he went, not a real person, Jenny. Can't use her as an example. You made her up. It's like, oh, but she's so real. And it's a hard thing to explain. Like, people think you're an idiot or that you're just out of your mind crazy when you try and explain that. But they really do feel like real people, you know, when you spend that much time writing your books and getting to know your characters. I mean, I know a lot of things about the characters in the books that aren't in the books, you know?
Yeah, because you have to have that whole character development so you know whether or not they would do a certain thing and how they would react to those things. That's I love that your husband can do that, though. Not a real person, Jenny.
He's a great sport, and he's just tremendously supportive. And really, that's what I mean. I actually get more nervous when he's reading than I do anyone else, just because his opinion it means a great deal. So,
and you said it's been pretty successful so far.
I think so. It's hard to I don't really know what kind of numbers to compare it to, but.
Is it typically women that are picking it up? Typically LDS people that are like, tell me about kind of that end.
Yeah, I mean it is. I mean it's a pretty LDS specific book. I mean it's a conversion story, and so I think you could probably take a little bit of. There's only a little bit of Mormon specific doctrine that you could take out, but it's still a very religious book anyway, and it's published by Covenant, so it's largely distributed in Utah, Idaho, Arizona, California. Mm-hmm. I mean. The closest bookstore that it's actually... Oh, that's not true. My local bookstore here in town carries it because I live here. But as far as LDS bookstores go, the closest one is in Columbia, South Carolina, and that's 4 hours away.
And we hate South Carolina, so we're not going there.
Listen, we love South Carolina. But it's funny, my husband actually graduated from the University of South Carolina. But my parents both graduated from the University of North Carolina, so I kind of feel like my blood runs like Tar Heel blue, and when you live in South Carolina, they call South Carolina Carolina, but Carolina is North Carolina. So there's a little bit of that, but that's just...
You know what's interesting is that Kate had that same experience. Do you remember? No, I'm just giving you a hard time.
Oh, shut up. I was thinking, did I write that into a book? Really? I don't remember that.
Now, wait, I don't remember that about Kate. Oh, I guess I'm going to have to ask her, and then you just start talking to yourself for a couple of minutes.
Sure. It's not ever that bad. I don't actually talk to them, not out loud.
I love it.
Sidewinder Media was named as one of Utah's top photographers by In This Week magazine and is a winner of several awards for fine art, portrait, and event photography. Sidewinder Media has been professionally photographing everything from wildlife to headshots for over 10 years. Sidewinder Media has the experience and the knowledge to capture your special occasion or portrait the way you want it. They also film and edit music or product videos and do simple ads for Facebook or websites. Email them at sidewindermedia@gmail.com or call Rusty at 801-941-5576 to book your shoot today.
And sorry, I got a little distracted in teasing you.
We were talking about sales.
So it's been received pretty well, and it's a dream come true. Yeah.
I think so. It was on the top. You know, it was in the top 20 of Deseret's fiction books for almost a month. So,
nice.
Yeah. So I think it did. I mean, for my first book, I'm really pleased with how well it's been received. I've gotten lots of nice emails and good reviews. It's funny because the book is classified as general fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because the romance is sort of a subplot. It's more about Kate's personal journey and about her family history. And so the audience has actually been a little bit older than I anticipated it was going to be, because I did focus a lot on the romance. But I've gotten a lot of emails from people that have... that really love family history, and so not to say that there hasn't been that young demographic as well, mm-hmm. but I have gotten lots of emails from older women as well that have said they really loved it. So
now, when you get into the family history part, I'll be honest, I hear family history and a fictional book about family history, and I go, doesn't that fictional character have something to do that's better than family history? Because to me,
right.
I just, you know?
Right. So it can be a little bit of a sleepy topic, but I hope that... that the way Kate experiences it is not sleepy for her. And you know, there's what it talks about really more than anything is recognizing that human aspect of those that lived before us, and recognizing that, you know, whether you lived 200 years ago or right now, there's a lot of things that make our lives different, but essentially, we have the same human experiences. We have the same struggles in our relationships, and, you know, someone lies and we feel betrayed. I mean, all of those things, those human struggles, have existed for hundreds upon hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And I think that there can be strength in recognizing that, that, you know, when we have the opportunity to learn from those that have had more experience than us, I think we should.
I hope to one day be addicted. You know how you meet those people that are addicted to family history?
Like, yeah.
That to me seems so foreign, but I hope to one day, you know, have that kind of passion and drive where it's like, yeah, you bet. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you should read my book. Oh, maybe it will inspire you.
Oh, well, all right. Don't boss me. I'll just do it. You don't have to be so bossy.
It was a suggestion.
It was a pretty,
you should. I didn't say you have to, right?
It was a pretty bossy suggestion. No, I'm just kidding. I'll do it.
Hey, listen, you called me.
After you emailed me.
I did. I did do that, didn't
I? Yeah, that did happen. Let me ask you this. How did you hear about the Cultural Hall?
Okay, I think the first person that I heard recommend the Cultural Hall was my friend Annette Lyon, who's another author.
Mm-hmm.
And she made a comment on Facebook, maybe, that mm-hmm. said it was great. And so my sister has been trying to convert me to podcast listening for a long time. She loves This American Life and Radiolab. And so I started listening to those and liked them. And, you know, I'd listen to them in the car or while I was getting ready in the morning. And so it was sort of after I'd listened to several of those podcasts, and I thought, this is actually a really great way. Like, when I'm running, I get on the treadmill and run, and I listen to a podcast, and it makes the time go by so much faster. And so then it was, you know, I only had those two little podcasts, and I thought, there's probably more out there. And then I remembered that Annette had suggested the Cultural Hall, so that's what made me go and look it up and try it out.
And what do you think?
I love it. You guys are very entertaining. I think it's great.
Even though we give you a hard time?
I need you to give me a hard time. It keeps me on my toes.
Yeah, because having six kids at home, that right. doesn't keep you on your toes. You need someone who does a podcast from Utah to reach out and give you a nudge every now and then.
Well, and do you know what? There are Mormons all over the country, and so it's like I said in my email. I mean, it is a little different out here, and sometimes it's good to talk about that, I think.
What do you think the biggest difference is out there to here? I mean, sheer numbers, obviously, that's a big deal.
Well, I mean, sure. I mean, we have like 75 people in our branch, so.
And you're a branch, not a ward, but do you think that there's fundamental things that are different?
That's hard to say. I mean, I went to school at BYU, and so I have very limited experience living in Utah, because, you know, I'm not deluded enough to think that living on campus at BYU is an accurate reflection of what it's like to live in Utah.
It's
in general.
Not.
I mean, the BYU experience is very unique. Now, I loved it. I loved going to school at BYU. I loved, for me, it was very exciting to live somewhere where there were a lot of people that understood what I believed in.
Uh-huh.
Because when you grow up in the South, I mean, we live in a really religious area. This is the Bible Belt. And so we have just as many churches here. They're just all Baptist.
Uh-huh.
Missionary work is very difficult because people are already so religious. They're going to church every Sunday. I mean, there are never any sports activities on Wednesday nights here because everybody goes to church. And everything's closed on Sundays except restaurants. Everybody goes to church and then they go out to eat.
Sure.
So it's a very religious area in general. And as a result of that, when you're Mormon, now I will say that it's a lot better now than it was even, you know, 15 years ago when I was in high school. But, I experienced quite a bit of, I don't know if I want to say persecution. That word sounds a little harsh.
No, use it. Throw it around. Throw pure persecution around.
I would say opposition more. I mean, like, I had a lot of moments where my faith was challenged. Over and over again, notes left in my locker, people saying things like, we're having prayer meetings for you, and really, we really hope that you find the light, and people sending me emails telling me that they were convinced that I was, going to hell. And actually, my favorite experience, in retrospect, I didn't love it too much in the moment, but I had just turned 16, and I was on a date with this guy And we'd gone out a couple of times, and I liked him, and I thought maybe this could go somewhere. I mean,
at 16, of course, you're like...
At 16, you know, however...
I love him! We will be together!
You know 16-year-olds really well.
Yes.
So he looks at me very seriously, and he takes my hand, and he tells me he needs to tell me something important, and he says, I don't want this to affect our relationship, Jenny, but I think you're going to hell. I mean, what do you say to that? It's like, wow. Well, I think it's going to affect our relationship, but... so, you know, I think when you live in a place where there are so many people that know so little about your faith, I had to decide really early what side of the fence I wanted to stand on, you know, because it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy to be the only Mormon in my high school. I think there were four of us, but none of them were in my my grade, you know, to have... no one that really, I mean, I had good friends that recognized what my standards were and understood what they were, and that helped. But there was, you know, there's a lot of loneliness when you feel like you're sort of on your own, and you have to decide if it's worth it. Are you willing to stand up for what you believe in and take those experiences in stride, or are you going to say, well, to heck with this. This is way harder than what I signed
up for.
Too hard. Yeah. And so I think if I had to quantify what the biggest difference is I think you don't have as much opportunity when you live in areas where the church is so sparse to be a cultural Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think when everybody goes to church, you know, you go to school with the people you go to church with, you can get caught up in everybody doing the same thing and in living the culture of the faith, regardless of whether or not you've really decided how strongly you believe in the faith. Now, that's not to say that that's how it is for everyone in Utah,
sure.
But I think there's more opportunity for that, where you can just get sort of caught up and get carried through in the momentum of being Mormon. Whereas here, there is no momentum. I mean, you just have to pull yourself up, and sometimes it's really hard, and sometimes you think, I mean, like, for example, there's two kids in our nursery, and they're both mine. And so for the past 3 or 4 months, we haven't had a nursery leader. And so I'm going to church, and I'm sitting with my kids, you know, all through sacrament meeting, and then I'm going into the nursery for 2 hours.
With your kids?
By myself.
Yeah.
With my kids. And I think I should just, you know, and I'm the music leader in primary, so I'm hanging out so I can go in and do music in primary, and things are great now. We've pulled ourselves together, and we have a nursery leader. But there were a couple of weeks where I thought, this is really stupid, and I'm just going to go home.
Right.
I mean, why am I here? And so, I don't know. I think there's less opportunity to... Am I making any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree with you. I've always said it's that in the state of Utah, or like you say, in areas where the church can be fairly prominent, and being a cultural Mormon, you can kind of be Mormon, but anywhere outside of that, you really can't kind of be. You kind
right.
of are, or you're not.
Right. Well, and we're just so desperate for people that
mm-hmm.
we really, you know, all of a lot of the discussions that can go on about the culture. I mean, you know, should women wear pantyhose to church? Should young women wear flip-flops to church? Or, you know, all of these things that you can get caught up in the letter of the law, like
mm-hmm.
how well you're living the faith. I don't feel as much of that out here because we're just, you know, you walk in and it's just like, do you play the piano? Can you help us? We're just
hey,
so
someone that's here. Thank you.
You've
thank
been
you,
a member
person.
35
from...
minutes.
Yes.
Here's a Sunday school lesson. We need you to teach that. I mean, we just need people. We need people that can serve. Because, I mean, we have fewer numbers, but we still have all the same programs that have to function. And so we really just like people to come and help. So,
you know, I suppose the other thing I like about that is you really feel needed.
Sure.
Whereas, you know, sometimes in these wards in Utah, you don't necessarily feel so needed. It's like, I'm there, but, you know, if I weren't there, that wouldn't be a big deal. People wouldn't be like, oh, where's Richie? They'd be like, nah, he's probably doing something else today.
Yeah. And it's a big deal when you don't show up and when you've got, and because we, you know, we all generally have more than one calling at a time. And then when you get new leadership, it's like you just sort of throw everyone up and shuffle, and then you fall back down in a different calling. But
yeah.
You don't ever really get, you know, you just play musical chairs.
Let me ask you this. Do you have a call, or what is your calling right now in your ward?
Right now, I am the primary music leader,
mm-hmm.
Which, and don't tell anyone, but that's my only one.
That's pretty coveted, isn't it? Isn't that a pretty coveted calling?
I really, really love it. It's probably one of my favorite places to be, just because when kids sing to you, it's like the sweetest thing ever. So I really love it. I've had this calling before I was music leader. I was the young women's president, and I was seminary teacher at the same time. And so I think I was due for a break.
Yeah.
So I'm enjoying this nice little respite of just having the one calling. So
if you could pick one for yourself, what would you pick?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. And, you know, I really love teaching. I've never done gospel doctrine, taught gospel doctrine or anything like that. I think that would really be fun. When I have youth, I think I will really love working with the youth. When I was the young women's president, it was tough because I had lots of little kids, and so it was hard to leave them all the time. But I really do love working with the youth. So when my kids are all older, I think that would be a great place to serve.
You're like, I'll still be writing, you know, three different books at a time, and I'll stay up till 11 with the youth, and then I'll get up at 4 and I'll write a book, and then we've got three more kids that we're going to have because you're only 32, as you pointed out. So, you got a lot of work.
That's not funny. Like, no. It was kind of funny until you said more kids, and then I just started to feel sick. So
you can feel very good in that you've done your part.
And
perhaps a little of my part too. So thank you.
Right. I do what I can.
Yeah.
Six kids is good. It's a good number.
Was that how it always was going to be? I always wonder that with six kids, because I think when I was single, if I would have been dating someone who said, "And six kids sounds like a great idea to me," I think I would have been like, I don't think so. I you're great, and then pat him on the head and then kick him out of the car.
Right. I always said growing up that I wanted six kids. After I had the twins, I thought three was fine and that we were going to be done forever. And it took us a little bit longer to muster up the courage for another after the twins. But I had originally always said that six was it. So,
Your husband was just like, well, whatever. Whatever keeps her happy.
No.
No?
Not quite. I mean, it took a little bit of prayer on his part to get there. But he wouldn't give any of them back. He's a great dad. I mean, it's hard. I'm not gonna lie. It is so hard to have this many children. I mean, there are many moments where we just look at each other and shake our heads and think, what were we thinking? But they go to sleep and you think about them, and
that's the best part.
Yeah, when they're sleeping.
Oh, they're angels.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. I think if it wasn't hard, it wouldn't be quite as worth it. Those moments where you feel that payoff and you recognize that their spirits just like ours are. They're just in younger bodies.
Yeah, and six of them as opposed to one. I'm just giving you a hard time. I shouldn't give you such a hard time. I'm going to make you feel bad.
No, I don't feel bad. I have been... looking at people, looking at my large family for,
because eight is two cars. That's what I think about. Eight is two cars or one really big van.
I know. What do you drive? Well, like, we're still driving a minivan, and it's not going to work for much longer.
Yeah.
The kids get bigger. Like, we already look like sardines.
Yes.
In there. And so I get you do. You just have to get a bigger car.
Tell me your favorite part of your faith.
Wow. My favorite part of my faith. I love the joy that comes from knowing my Savior so personally. One of the things that you see a lot in Protestant Christianity is, that misery, wallowing in that misery, and there's so much focus on the crucifixion, and we're so awful and we're so low, and Jesus died for us because we're sinners,
mm-hmm.
Which we are. But I love that our faith teaches us to focus on the joy of the resurrection. And that we get to feel that love that our Savior has from us. Because, yes, we're sinners, and, yes, it's awful that our Savior had to die for us, but he did it out of love, and that's something that we should really feel happy about. And I think we can be so much more motivated to do the right thing and to live as our Savior would have us live when we think about that joy that he wants us to feel. It's something to celebrate. And, if we beat ourselves up and call ourselves sinners all the time, I mean, we don't need to forget
right.
that we need to repent. But what an incredible, beautiful gift the atonement is. And I love that joy. And I think that's what I love the most about Mormons is that we are such a happy people. There's just so much to feel joy about and be happy about, even when it's, you know, a house full of kids that are loud and chaotic. And I love the joy.
Let's talk about one more. Come on, you guys could have one more, right? Seven.
No, come on.
Come on. It's so different.
Do you want to get into like the medical reasons?
No. I mean, I just want to harass you because it's not any different.
You know, probably not, except we would have to, like, put a wagon on the back of our car.
Well, sure, but you're going to have to buy a bigger van anyway. A seventh kid doesn't eat much more than six kids, you know?
Right, probably not.
You
know what? Four more.
Yeah. No, now you're being ridiculous.
No, six is good. We are done.
You know what you got to teach him to do?
What?
You got to teach him to do some of your writing or editing for you. That way you have like a little writing chop shop or chop shop with it. They take care of everything for you.
Do you know there are people that really do that? I mean, when you are super famous and you've written like hundreds of books, I mean, you have like a little team of shadow writers that write for you.
No, that's what I'm talking about. But it should be your kids. Put them to work.
Totally. Do you think that would affect the quality of my writing?
You know what?
At first
it would, sure.
Maybe.
But then maybe it becomes a novelty where people are like, holy cow, a six-year-old wrote this? And then you ride that wave.
Maybe so.
And then you have a seventh kid and it's a miracle and you write a book about that. See?
No. We're not going to go down that road.
You get off the phone. Hey, hubby, we're supposed to have a seventh kid. I would like for you to do that and then get back to me and let me know how that goes.
Right. No, I can already tell you exactly how it would go.
Tell me.
I mean, do you know how much it is very expensive to have children.
Yeah. But
it costs a lot of money. Yeah. No, we're good. Good. We have to consider the mental health of the parents.
I love it. I love that it's this great discussion about your book, and then the last 5 minutes of it are all about me harassing you and having more kids.
I know. Well, so let's talk about the book that's coming out next year. It's another one, and it's coming out in August.
What's it called? Oh, you don't have a working title for it?
I don't have a title. Mountains Between Us is the working title. Maybe I'll get lucky, and they'll let me keep it.
Okay.
The title.
And you'll come back on and talk about that?
I would love to. And then I'm also working on another one that I hope will be, it's my first mainstream fiction attempt.
Okay.
So it would not go to Covenant. I will have to go through the arduous process of getting an agent and trying to get a, you know, big city publisher for it is outside of the LDS genre.
Mental work and capacity to have a seventh child, no, can't do that, but you can write two more books and have six kids.
Can.
Okay, well, good.
Yes, I can.
All right.
I don't have to have surgery to have the books removed, so it's a little bit easier to do it that way, to just write a book.
I'm sorry that this ended like this.
Are you married? Your wife should give you a hard time for how much you're harassing me about this.
Oh, I give her the same hard time, because we have one child, and he is my stepson. And so I'm all of the time saying, you know, we could have one. I could do that. We could do this.
Sure.
And we're not too old. We're not too old to have them. Come on, let's do it. Let's have one. Let's have two, I've often said.
Or three or seven.
No, I don't want that many.
No.
But I have pushed for the one or two. So far, I'm not winning.
Do you know what the very best thing is about having lots of kids?
That you're never alone.
Do you have time for me to tell you this?
Yes,
no,
please.
I am never alone. Like, I can't, the dog will even scratch on the door. And my three-year-old knows how to get my keys and, like, unlock the door. So there's no privacy, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I love seeing my, you know, my big, sweaty seventh grade son, who, I mean, 12-year-olds, it's just this awkward stage where everything about them is sort of, you know, they're clumsy and they're...
They're clumsy and they're moody and they're stinky.
Yes. All of those things, but I didn't say them, so my son can't rib me for it.
Oh,
but
okay.
Thank you. Yes, all of that. So he will walk in the room, and he will, even if he's sullen and upset about something, and he will walk past his brother's high chair and still want to stop and kiss the baby on the head.
Aww.
And that's the most rewarding thing, is seeing the relationships develop between my kids. I have learned so much more about the character of my older children in seeing how they handle the often frustrations of having younger children around. And they're so good, and they're so patient, and they're You know, I mean, those are some really incredible life experiences. We've just started letting our oldest son babysit. You know, when he turned 12, it was the most incredible, liberating thing to just, we put the babies to bed because we kind of feel like it wouldn't be fair to leave him with all of the kids awake.
Sure.
So we put the little ones to bed, and then we'll go, you know, we'll go out to dinner at like 8 o'clock. And that's amazing because we pay him $2 an hour.
Yeah, there you go. See,
it's way cheaper than regular babysitting.
Now, that's the sweatshop I was talking about.
Absolutely. But listen, he gets paid to, like, sit and play Minecraft and watch movies. It's a deal.
That sounds good to me.
So he gets up with his little sister. His little sister wakes up at, like, 10:30 in the middle of the night. Or, that's not middle of the night, but, you know, it is for her.
Uh-huh.
So he gets up with her, and she has to go to the bathroom. He goes into the bathroom and helps her. And in the process, he totally gets pee, like, all down the front of him.
Ugh.
So at 12 years old, he's cleaning her up. He cleans up the bathroom. He cleans himself up. And, I mean, terrible experience to have to live through. But what a character-building experience to have the opportunity to care for his sister and to be gentle and to, you know, help her get back to sleep. I love that about having a big family, is that I think your kids learn a lot from loving and assisting and helping each other.
So. We hope that this podcast has nourished and strengthened your body, and that if you weren't healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat on the back row.